Blog Talk Radio. Mustafa Turin wrote in the Doma Jews that Muhammad Ibn Abdul Wahhab was a descendant of a family of Doma Jews from Turkey. The Doma were descendants of followers of the infamous false messiah of Judaism, Shabbatai Zevi, who shocked the Jewish world in 1666 by converting to Islam. Viewing it as a sacred mystery, Zevi's followers imitated his conversion to Islam through secretly keeping their Kabbalistic doctrines. In Europe, the Shabbatins were eventually led a century later by Jacob Frank, claiming to be the reincarnation of Zevi. And according to Rabbi Adelman in the Eliminate the Opiate, to them belonged the Rothschilds, who had in founding, that doesn't make sense,
and
of course, hand in founding of the Bavarian Illuminati. The Donma community of Turkey were concentrated in the city of Salonika, which became a hotbed of Masonic activity and for which the Young Turk movement involved, which aided in the collapse of the Muslim Empire of the Ottoman Turks. There is evidence that Ataturk himself, the founder of the modern Turkish state, was of Domna origin as well. Well, I suppose we all can trace back to all kinds of things.
Well, but it's interesting that they were all Jews.
Yeah.
The notion of the Saudi family being of Jewish heritage has been published by Mohammed Saktar, who it is claimed was ordered killed by the regime for his revelations. The report relates a similar account, but from different sources, according to Wahhabi Movement, The Truth and Roots by Abdul Wahhab Ibrahim al-Shamari, who, for example, Ibn Saud, the Saudi dynasty, is actually descended from Mordecai bin Ibrahim bin Muji, a Jewish merchant from Basra. And apparently, when he was approached by members from the Arabian tribe of Aniza, then claimed to be one of them, and traveled with them to Najd, and his name became Makan ibn Ibrahim bin Muji. But additionally, Abu Mahab was descended from, who the hell? It just gets crazier and crazier. But it shows 5,000, I'll tell me, 35,000 genii in the year 1943, to forge a family tree of the Saudi family and that of Abdul Wahhab and merge them into one, claiming their origin from the Prophet of Muhammad.
Well, it would be difficult to independently authenticate these claims. They are interesting in light of the role that the state of Saudi Arabia has and continues to play with regard to supporting and advancing Western power in the Middle East and elsewhere. Especially astounding is the very dubious and virulent form of Islam that Wahhabism and Salafism represent, which is currently wreaking havoc on Islamic tradition and dividing the Muslim community in petty squabbles over trivial details, allowing the war on Islam to proceed effectively unchecked.
So I thought that was fascinating. Did you?
Yeah. Well, we all can trace ourselves back to something, right?
No. I don't think there's any Jewishness in me, but
you never know.
No, I do trace back. There's Indian in me for sure, but not and French. But no. I don't think there was anybody who was a Jew. But it doesn't matter.
You don't know who those French people were, though.
That's true.
You don't really know much about them.
Obama's new second-in-command at the Department of Defense, Ashton Carter, CFR, Aspen Group, Goldman Sachs, connects to 911 false flag. Today it was announced that Ashton Carter would be appointed as deputy dog at the Pentagon under Leon Panetta.
Great.
Just a few months back, he published a scathing review of Mr. Panetta here at Deadline. Republished a scathing review of Mr. Panetta here at Deadline Live and .info. Though we were no fans of Mr. Gates, it was well of him to stand up against the Libyan war. Panetta is 1,000 times worse than Romney. Is anyone maybe maybe. Panetta is a UN boy and a global warming hawk who is the rear pocket of the world WWF. I don't know what WWF is. WWF.
I don't know what that is.
Head Prince Philip, who wants to rid the planet of 80% of you useless eaters. And so I do protest. Okay. Let's see what this clown is talking about.
You're having trouble reading that.
I don't know why. It's rough reading here. Deadline, Deadline Live with Jack Blood. It can be said that the number two in any office is the real controller of things. Think big time Dick Tater Cheney, or Webb Hubble, or for Janet Reno, or Death Squad pimp Iran-Contra crook John Dimitri Negroponte under Condi Rice, and Paul Wolfowitz under Colin Powell. Even more recently, newly appointed Chicago mob boss, once Obama's C of S, What the hell is a C of S?
I don't know.
Oh, C of S. Must be Czar of Science.
It has to be Rahm Emanuel.
Oh, Chief of Staff.
Chief of Staff.
Okay, C of S. Okay, Chief of Staff. Rothschild Handler. Rambo Emanuel under Cousin Barry, or the King of Second Fiddles, George H.W. Bush, under Ronald Reagan. And GHWB, or George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, has continued to handle every president since. He has called Bill Clinton his son and have recently been spotted going through the back door of the Obama White House with his son's jibby in tow. Ooh, interesting. We could go on and on in this vein, but suffice to say, we are always interested in who gets the number two spot in any department in government. Panetta and Carter. Today it was announced that Ashton Carter would be appointed as deputy dog at the Pentagon under Leon Panetta. But just a few months back, we published a scathing review of Mr. Panetta here at the Deadline.
Oh, that's
Live.
What you read.
Right. And though we were no fans of Mr. Gates, it was swell of him to stand up against the living war. But Panetta is a thousand times worse. To recap on Leon Panetta. Okay. Panetta is a major show for LOST, the UN Law of the Sea Treaty, which gives the world's oceans to the New World Order to tax and regulate. Panetta, a CIA enforcement arm of CFR. Panetta's life has been devoted not to the USA, but to the United Nations. He has been a fanatic for world government and a Hitlerian New World Order. Leon Panetta devoted himself to the election of Nelson Rockefeller, who had written The Future of Federalism, in which Rockefeller writes, "I think the answer is some free world supranational being with the power to tax." Well, Panetta worked...
For Nelson Rockefeller in California, it was mass murderer Ted Bundy, who was Nelson Rockefeller's...
Point man
in Seattle. Oh my God. Leon Panetta worked for Mayor John Lindsay, Scroll and Key Yale, read America's Secret Establishment. Lindsay went to St. Paul's School. Lindsay was a member of the CFR, so Leon Panetta was right at home, the Destroy America Sovereignty crowd. Lindsay's school is part of the 10 Schools Admissions Organization, a recruiting ground for the administrators of the New World Order. St. Paul's school include J.P. Morgan Jr., Vanderbilt, future Skull and Bones members Kennedy and J. Peter Gray, some of the incorporator of the Council of Foreign Relations. Panetta has been co-opted from the beginning by the super-rich and the international community, whole of his life. Their goals and his goals. Today, Leon is chair of the Pew Commission on Oceans. This smiling lawyer is the plausible local face to impose Rockefeller United Nations plans. The harmonization of local community using Agenda 21 in preparation of the North American Union was prepped by the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Open borders were designed to cause racial conflict, lower middle class wages, and the smothering of America until the people call for martial law and peace, the kind they have in Cuba. This designed to be implemented after the present ongoing murder of the USA. It was the Rockefellers who donated the very land that the UN headquarters sits on. Leon is also affiliated with the Knights of Malta. Leon Panetta is not a greenhorn. He has been working for the Illuminati for years. His choice as CIA chief and now DOD head, for those who see through the smokescreen, it should come as no surprise.
But the reason we write you today is to alert you to who Leon's second in command is and build our case against him, eventually running the Pentagon. Meet Ashton Carter. Carter was previously the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. Here he was touted as the man who saved us money by being instrumental in several aspects of former Defense Secretary Robert Gates' cost-cutting program and has closely monitored efforts to remedy troubles with the F-35 fighter program. Oh, really? Was Carter asleep at the wheel or complicit in robbing the American taxpayer blind? Recent reports of Pentagon waste are staggering. Here's a jaw-dropping example reported by Bloomberg.
A U.S. contractor in Iraq overbilled for the Pentagon by at least $4.4 million for spare parts and equipment, including $900 for an electronic control switch valued at $7.05, according to a new audit. Based on the questionable cost identified in the $300 million contract with Dubai-based Anham LLC, the U.S. should review all its contracts with the company in Iraq and Afghanistan, which total about $3.9 billion, said Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction Stuart Bowen. The audit found weak oversight in multiple areas that left the government vulnerable to improper charges, Bowen wrote in the foreword to his 30th quarterly report released today. The contract in question was funded with a combination of money earmarked for Iraqi security forces and army operations and maintenance funds. Among the egregious examples of overbilling by Anham were $4,500 for a circuit breaker valued at $183, $3,000 for a $94 circuit breaker, and $80 for a small segment of drain pipe valued at $1.41.
Those markups are absurd, but I wonder whether this example from the story is even worse. In other cases, Anham used subcontractors to purchase items that could have been bought directly from the manufacturer at lower prices. The report said when Anham was asked to buy a loudspeaker system to alert warehouse employees of any danger, he chose not to buy the system directly from the manufacturer at the retail price of $44,615. The report said. Instead, Anham sought bids for the subcontractors and paid a company called Nology $90,908. That price included $20,000 for installation, even though the system setup meant little more than wheeling it into place and plugging it in. Oh, God. Heck of a job, Brownie. For this, Carter gets promoted, and apparently, having friends in high places is more important than effectiveness in the job. Well, that's always the case. Here are some of Carter's connections and affiliations. Whoa. Dr. Carter was also senior partner at Global Technology Partners. GTP's partners have collectively served as Secretary of Defense, Director of Central Intelligence, Deputy Director of White House Office of Management and Budget, Deputy Secretary of Defense, and Secretary of Energy, Undersecretary of Defense, Assistant Secretary of Defense 3 times. Okay, these are just people that were in this company?
I guess so.
GTP's partners, yeah, the partners of the company that he was senior partner at.
All
right?
All those people got to work for the government.
All those people worked in high offices in the government. And GTP had been linked to the Rothschild family, banking family, and has at least some suspicious connections to the events of 9/11. He is a member of the Board of Trustees of the MTRE Corporation and Advisory Board of MIT's Lincoln Laboratories and the Draper Laboratory. Man. Okay, the MITRE Corporation. which generally styles the song name as MITRE in all caps, is a not-for-profit organization based in Bedford, Mass., and McLean, Virginia. It manages federally funded research and development centers supporting the Department of Defense and Federal Aviation Administration. The Internal Revenue Service, the Department of Veteran Affairs, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts on behalf of the Federal Judiciary. This is one corporation?
Yeah, why does that get to do all this?
It's a non-for-profit owned based in Bedford, Mass. It manages federally funded research and development centers.
I don't really understand
supporting,
that.
Yeah, well, it manages federally funded research and development centers supporting the Department of Defense. Holy Christ. And all these, man, oh, man. I mean, I'm very
curious. No wonder
curious.
We have no money.
Yeah. I'm so curious.
Everybody's
how these
sucking
guys,
off the government.
How do these sons of bitches get so much power? You know? How are they appointed? I mean, what do they do? You know, how do these guys do it?
They all went to St. Paul's together.
Yeah, was MITRE the Trojan horse of 9/11? MITRE, that company, MITRE, Bedford's headquarters, are located near Boston's Logan Airport, where the two planes that struck the World Trade Center supposedly originated. Bedford lies directly under the flight path of westbound flights leaving Logan. MITRE developed the technology to aid controllers in solving problems while keeping aircraft close to their route, altitude, and speed preferences. Sherman was unable to say why the MITRE technology apparently failed on 9/11. Isn't that interesting? Indira Singh, an IT consultant who previously worked on a Defense Advanced Research project and who was employed by J.P. Morgan on 9/11, in risk management, pointed to MITRE's role at the FAA during the 9/11 Citizens Commission hearing in New York last September. PTEC was with MITRE Corporation in the basement of the FAA for 2 years prior to 9/11, Singh said. Their specific job is to look at interoperability issues that the FAA had with NORAD and the Air Force in the case of the emergency. If anyone was in a position to know that the FAA, that there was a window of opportunity or to insert software or to change anything, it would have been PTEC along with MITRE. Whoa. So Carter worked directly with Philip Zyko, who oversaw the 9/11 CFR Whitewash Commission that covered up the truth about the events of 9/11. Together they authored catastrophic terrorism, elements of national policy. This report was a product of the Catastrophic Terrorism Study Group, which has headed by Ashton B. Carter, and John M. Deutsch, and project director is Philip D. Zelico. Okay, together they helped to set up U.S. terrorism policies that ran amok during the Bush administration. So Carter is on board with corporations that helped cause 9/11. Then crafts policy with co-conspirators to provide a solution for 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
That covering all your Hegelian bases, folks. Yeah, you know, the conflict. What is it? Crisis. Conflict. The three things. Resolution. They start the crisis. You know, crisis.
They create the
problem, and then
they come rushing in with the solution,
yeah.
Which in the end you realize you really don't want.
Yeah, well, it's just designed to take away your rights, take away your money, take away everything, destroy the government. Carter was also a consultant to Goldman Sachs on international affairs and technology matters. He has been a member of the Aspen Strategy Group, the Council on Foreign Relations. He is a Rhodes Scholar, all right, for British global domination. He was on the board at the Rockefeller Center. Dr. Carter received bachelor's degrees in physics and medieval history from Yale. Also, his bio touts affiliations with the American Physical Society, the International Institute of Strategic Studies, the advisory board of the Yale Journal of International Law. I mean, how the hell does a guy get to be all these things? You know,
how does he have time?
How does he have time, and how is he connected to every single, conspiracy issue in the world here?
Well, the bottom line is that he doesn't go to all of them. He goes to one or two.
No, but he's in charge of so much of it. He likely aided in the selling or trading of nuclear and high-tech secrets to China. Carter was a head honcho in the area of keeping WMDs and nukes out of the hands of terrorists. He was on Secretary of State Condoleezza's International Security Advisory Board from 2006 to 2008. But Dr. Carter served as a member of the Defense Science Board from 1991 to 1993, and he advised on the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. He was chairmanship of NATO's high-level group. I mean, this guy has more credentials than the President of the United States.
Well, he has food.
What do you mean he has food?
I was thinking about something else. Yes, he does have more credentials, but, just about anyone seems to. Obama came out of nowhere.
Yeah, but this guy is...
But he's connected. He's connected to everybody and everything.
And the fact that he's only second banana to Panetta is...
Well, what they're saying in this article, it's not the top guy that you have to be concerned about. The top guy's window dressing. The second banana is the one that runs everything.
It was like Cheney ran Bush. Yeah. And it's no different here. This guy's running everything. How can we do better? If by some hypothetical miracle I was elected president of the USA, I would fix the situation quickly and without doubt. I would install Bob Bowman as secretary, Colonel Bob Bowman as Secretary of Defense. I would allow him to pick his entire support staff and approve a massive budget cut to the Pentagon. We met Bob Bowman, remember, at the 9/11 commission?
Yeah.
And
he was a bright guy.
Yeah. And so on and so forth. But I'll tell you. This is our new guy. Look at this guy. Looks like a friggin' zombie.
Yeah.
And this is the guy who's in charge of our...
Doesn't give me much hope.
No, not at all. Not at all. This is one nightmare of a son of a bitch. Scary. Really scary. Anyway. Let me see what we got here. Maybe we got a little. Yeah. Here's something.
Seven lies in under 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Obama lies seven times in under 2 minutes. That has to be some kind of record.
Yeah, let's see what that is. Hang on, it's an audio. Hopefully it works.
Lies.
And transparent so that anyone can ensure that our business is the people's business. As Justice Louis Brandeis once said, sunlight is the greatest disinfectant. And as president, I'm going to make it impossible for congressmen or lobbyists to slip pork barrel projects or corporate welfare into laws when no one's looking, because when I'm president, meetings where laws are written will be more open to the public, no more secrecy. That's the commitment I make to you as president. And
lie number five.
When there's a bill that ends up on my desk as president, you, the public, will have 5 days to look online and find out what's in it before I sign it. So that you know what your government's doing.
That didn't happen.
When there are meetings between lobbyists and a government agency, we'll put as many of those meetings as possible online for every American to watch. When there's a tax bill being debated in Congress, you will know the names of the corporations that would benefit and how much money they would get. And we will put every corporate tax break and every pork barrel project online for every American to see. You will know who asked for them, and you can decide whether your representative is actually representing you.
Fascinating. That was seven lives in 1.5 minutes. Unbelievable, huh? Yeah. Mr. Obama is a liar. Liar, liar. pants on fire.
Unbelievable.
What do you think, Carolina? Greece and panic as it faces change of Homeric proportions.
I think what amazed me is that it was one right after the other.
It was 2 minutes in, I don't know how big a speech, but in 2 minutes, the guy lied 7 times. Nothing he said in his presidency has come through.
No.
He's just one stinking liar. But, hey, what can you do? Bush was as big a liar as well. So,
yeah, all supported by the same guy.
What do you mean?
H.W. Bush.
Oh, yeah. So, anyway, Greece in panic as it faces changes of Homeric proportions.
Hmm.
What do you think? Want to read that?
Yeah, okay.
Officials figure back him up.
In May alone, almost $5 billion was pulled out of pounds.
Euros.
Pulled up, euros. 4.4 billion euros.
Pounds. €5 billion, which equals
4.4 billion
pounds,
was pulled out of Greek deposits as part of what analysts describe as a silent bank run. This version is also disorderly and jittery, just not as obvious. Customers do not form long queues outside branches. They simply squirrel out as much as they can. Some of that money will have been used to pay debts or supplement incomes, of course. But bankers put the sheer volume of withdrawals down to a general fear about the outlook for Greece, one that runs all the way from the humble rainy day saver to the really big money.
In one of the biggest banks in the center of Athens, a clerk is explaining how his savers have been thronging to pull out their cash. Wary of giving his name, he glances around the marble floor, wooded paneled foyer, before pulling out a slim A4-sized folder. It is about the size of a small safety deposit box, and those ever since the financial crisis hit Greece 18 months ago have become the most sought-after financial products in the country. Worried about whether the banks will stay in business, Greeks have been taking their life savings out of accounts and sticking them in metal slits in basement vaults. Wow.
The boxes are so popular that the bank has doubled the rent on them in the past year, and still every day between 5 and 10 customers request one. The bank ran out of spares months ago. The clerk leans over. I've been working in a bank for 31 years, and I've never seen panic like this. Official figures back him up. In May alone, almost 5 billion euros was pulled out of the Greek deposits as part of what analysts describe as a silent bank run. This version is also disorderly and jittery, just not as obvious. This is what we read. So, clueless
government. Yeah.
Every time the markets move, I get phone calls, says Athens-based fund manager. They're from investors asking, how can I get my money out of the country? One senior investment banker is more blunt. People are scared that the government doesn't know what the fuck it's doing. He tells the bank, tells a story about an acquaintance who took out 30,000 euros, wrapped it in a bag, and stashed it in his garage. The bag had previously had some food inside, he says, so it attracted rats who ate the notes.
Oh,
bags of money in garages, frightened savers fleeing banks, and even the country. These aren't the sort of stories you associate with a comparatively prosperous European country, but with a developing one facing a life or death economic crash. The fact they are now emerging from Greece not only indicates the scale of financial distress, it suggests something else. Greece today looks like parts of Latin America in the worst moments of its financial crises. In an echo of the days of Jim Callahan, the International Monetary Fund is back in Europe doing what it is more accustomed to doing in Buenos Aires or Brasilia, making emergency loans and telling the government how to run its economy. What is more, the scale of the changes and overborrowed Athens is now making it so fast and so rapid that they will leave Greece looking like a different country. The government itself describes its plan to slash public spending and jack up taxes. It's one of the most ambitious deficit reduction programs in the world, but what often goes missing from the discussion of a financial crash landing is the impact of the lives of the citizens who have precious little time to adjust when salaries of civil servants have slashed up to 30% within a few months, as happened last year, and over 20% of public sector workers face unemployment within the next 4 years, plus whole swaths of national assets are to be privatized before Christmas, with more job losses doubtless to follow. That you are talking about a whole transformation of a workforce. Greece is already one of the poorest, most unequal societies in Europe, reckons Christos Papandouro at the Democritus University of Thrace. Among the few countries that look worse are Romania, Bulgaria, and Latvia. So what will Greece's society look like after the government's austerity measures take effect? He pauses and then says it will probably look like a developing country. That message has not been lost on workers either. One of the new nouns used by trade union members and others who oppose the cuts is kizanopolisi,
China isolation.
The claim is that such large drops in wages will lead to a workforce paid barely more than the counterparts in Shenzhen, which is part of China. The oddest thing of all is that some of the leading lights in the government appear to see nothing wrong in a wholesale transformation of Greek society. Alabet, not into one of them, one that resembles an enterprise zone in eastern China. Alina Panarartis is widely tipped as one of the up-and-comers in Greece government. Is not hard to see why. Smart, formerly well-trained in economics after a career with the World Bank, funny and fluent in English. She is exactly the sort of person any prime minister would choose to give a keynote address to fretful institutional investors. And for a Greek politician involved in pushing through some of the most abruptly painful economic measures in the country's history, she does not seem especially Greek. When I observe how many Apple computers are in her office, she replies, "That's because I'm not Greek, I'm American." Her speech is American accented, peppered with darn and have a nice day. When asked to describe how Greece needs to change its economy, her answer revolves around changing its institutions and its structures. In other words, making Greece less Greek. Castigating the bureaucracy, she said it's not a kibbutz, it's a big country. This is a line that you hear often enough from those who want Greece to change. By European standards, Greece has an average-sized public sector, but a very leaky tax collection system. What the public sector is, however, is under-resourced and inefficient. On my last day in the country, I wangled my way inside a public pension office for those working in the tourism industry. There are just two Dell computers in one large room, a lever arch file dating back 30 years. No one ever paid for the data to be computerized, I'm told. And the result is that Dave's work takes three.
Private sector woes. I don't know if you want to go through this.
It's quite a long article.
Actually, it's almost done.
Excuse me. No, it has about six more paragraphs. Pardon me. It must be some pollen coming in the window. I apologize, folks.
Again, you want me to work on this?
Well,
private sector woes. Yeah, the problem here that I see, and this is what really scares me, is how this is starting to parallel what's happening here.
Yeah.
When you start seeing this austerity, when you start seeing the public workers getting slashed, and the banks failing. We've had five banks in this country fail just this last week, and I'm telling you, it's not good, not good at all. And you start seeing this stuff, it starts to, start to see it. And one of the big problems is in the private sector with few industries that are able to pay their way in the world. Jason Manopoulos, who is an author of a new book called Greece's Odious Debt, says that for years Greece was buying more from the rest of the world than it was selling. And we were buying BMWs from Germans and selling them tomatoes. For now, those days are well and truly over. In Athens Update, shopping...
upmarket.
Upmarket. Shopping district of Kolonaki, boutiques that used to have waiting lists for designers' handbags have shut. And one sign says that the owners have relocated to Rome. And one clothes shop with racks of discounted Calvin Klein and Dinky, Dickney, rather, the manager, Sav, explains that what happened. In this crisis, the middle classes have been hollowed out. This is just what happened in Buenos Aires during its crash last decade. So the result is that people who thought themselves used to one way of life and one social class are getting used to a sharp downgrade. In one factory, where a staff of 200 is now down to 30, the manager points to empty floors and idle machines, and they're now on all unemployment benefits. He says, mind you, our pay has been cut too, so we're not that far off. And outside the soup kitchen at the Agia Church
in Piraeus,
near Athens, more of Greece's new poor are waiting for a handout. Anna and her two daughters have walked in the midday sun to get here and are now queuing up with the long-term homeless. That is not Anna's situation, though. She lost her job 3 years ago, but has still hung on to her house. That said, she no longer has the income or the benefits to pay bills, and the electricity was cut off last month. Inside, Pater Danielle, the head priest, says that he's noticed a lot more well-dressed, clean people taking free meals from the church. He reels off stories of a 23-year-old man who left last week for Australia and a 40-year-old woman who lost her job on Friday. Because the Greek Orthodox Church is partly on the state payroll, the clergyman's salary has fallen by almost 10% to the 15,000 euro a year. And is he saying that the Orthodox Church is also subject to public spending cuts? Pater Daniels laughs when holds up five fingers. There are five priests in Priest, and soon there will only be one. He's pondering taking a second job. There is too much pain. People are looking for someone to listen and squeeze their hand, he sighs. Every day, I leave this church with a headache. So that's the plight of Greece. And, what scares me so much is that, you see it here. You see a lot of this stuff here happening. The parallels are
on, scary.
They're so obvious.
Is there an audio that we could...
Yeah, there is. I wanted to do this. Heads of Sand, Israel's biggest anti-government protest is ignored by the media. And I think this is critical because Israel's falling apart as well. And
well, they'll just get more money from us as
well. Well, the thing is that they're falling apart. And I think that's important to look at. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
In about 4 minutes.
In Israel, mainstream media are being accused of burying their heads in the sand over coverage of the biggest anti-government protest the country has.
Did we play this last night?
Yeah, we did.
Okay, sorry, though. I'm sorry, folks. We played that one last night. It's on our Tuesday night show.
It's very good.
This one, should probably mention this, unless I could find something else here. Here's something interesting. Debbie Schussel gloats over Norway's killing, the true face of Zionism.
This is in England.
Yeah.
You should go to the article.
I will.
Because otherwise you're reading something that's from the center of the article.
Project Mind Week.
Mm.
All right.
Less ultra-right-wing Jewish Zionist blogger Debbie Schussel has shown the ugliest side of American neoconservatism by saying that the terrorist shooting spree at a Norwegian Labour Party youth camp was karma for the group's political opposition to Israeli treatment of Palestinians living in Gaza and the West Bank. Noting that a pro-Palestinian rally was held at the camp the day before the shooting, Schussel wrote on July 29th that these hateful, privileged brats at the camp boycott Jews and side with Jew killers. What goes around comes around. You support terrorism against innocent civilians in Israel, then you get attacked by terrorists who are upset with your support. Norway has announced that it will support a move by the Palestinian Authority at the United Nations to be recognized as an official state, should the matter come up for a vote this September. The creation of a Palestinian state was a position endorsed by Presidents Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. Many Israeli politicians, including current conservative Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, have also approved the concept. For me, this is like alien versus predator, Scheisel continued. I'm not sad for either side, and I make no apologies for it. While claiming she does not condone a massacre of innocent civilians, Scheisel wrote, now these kids' families know what it feels like to be victims of the Islamic terrorists whose Judean boycotts and terrorist flotillas against Israel they support. We don't live in a vacuum. I can't feel sorry for those who support my would-be assassins, and I don't get too upset when they face the karma that is their fate. Oh, lovely person. I don't even want to read her.
That's Jewish, Zionist. Sure, her condoning of the karmic fate of the more than 70 massacred reflect the motives given by self-confessed killer Andrei Breivik, who targeted the left-wing youth for the political party's open immigration and pro-Muslim policies. A Christian Zionist, Breivik, saw Israel as an ally against his own crusade against jihadism.
I thought this woman came from England, but she's an American.
No, she's American. No, but this is a frightening Zionist bitch, I'll tell you that right now. And about taking her blog, conservative political commentator, radio talk show host, columnist, and attorney, who is not sick, Chosel's unique experience, expertise on radical Islam, Islamic terror, and a host of other issues make her a popular speaker and television, radio, news, talk show guest, both nationally and internationally.
What is her expertise? She's writing a hateful blog. That's her expertise.
Her online fan club is the Internet's second largest for a political personality, behind only Ann Coulter. Holy crap. She is a University of Michigan graduate, holds both law and MBA degrees from the University of Wisconsin, as both an attorney and a frequent New York Post and Journal Jerusalem Post columnist, Schlussel.
Schlussel.
Writing commentary on radical Islam and her illegal actions against radical Islamic parties have gotten a great deal of attention and results. Columns she has written for the New York Post and made appearances on Fox's O'Reilly.
How about that?
So she's a warmongering Zionist whore. Oh my God. Ugh. And she's this is sick.
She gets around.
Oh, I'm sick, babe. I'll tell you that. Debbie Schlussel. Super Congress. Final nail in the coffin. Representative democracy and freedom as we know it. Now, we might go out on this one tonight.
Yeah.
I'm getting a little hoarse myself. But
yeah.
You too?
Yeah, let's see if we have a little audio.
I'd like to find one. I don't see one here tonight. But
yeah, here's one. Webster Tarpley, NATO declares international anarchy. That should be interesting.
Right, it's about 5 minutes.
Yeah. He's always, Webster Tarpley is always interesting.
Yeah. There we go. NATO declares international anarchy by Webster Griffin Tarpley.
Now we're joined by Webster Griffin Tarpley. He's an author and historian. Dr. Tarpley, thank you for joining us on World News. How long will NATO continue its air raids? More importantly, how much longer will Muammar Gaddafi, do you think, stay in power?
I think Gaddafi is destined to stay in power for quite a while. I think he's likely to view the fall of people like Sarkozy, Cameron, maybe Obama, and maybe some others. NATO would like to continue their attacks, but the problem they have is that they're going to run up against this mid-September deadline that's built into the United Nations Security Council resolution. At that point, they will need a new resolution, and I'll be very surprised if Russia decides to put more egg on its face by not vetoing such a resolution. You also have to look at the fact that the coalition is falling apart. As of right now, Libya time, Norway has dropped out of the coalition. Over here, we've got Anne-Marie Slaughter, who is a leading hawk, one of the first advocates for the bombing under humanitarian cover, now saying it's time to compromise. She's basically admitting defeat. As a result of the death of Yunus, there are now so many questions about the terrorist faction fights among the top honchos of the rebel council there in Benghazi that the British press is saying that Cameron won't be able to continue. Berlusconi says that he didn't want to do it. He was forced to do it by Obama, and he was talked into it by President Napolitano of Italy, who, interestingly enough, is an old communist who's now become a warmonger for NATO. So if you look at this coalition, it's in total disarray. One other thing, if you're following the U.S. House of Representatives in this budget fight, when that gets over with, you've got to have a lot of mad Tea Party Republicans looking for an issue that they can use against Obama. I have an idea. Libya and Obama's violation of the War Powers Act might be that issue.
Well, Dr. Tarpley, you say that he's going to stay in power for a longer time. Do you think the revolutionaries can capture Brega, and is that the key point holding Gaddafi in power? If they capture, will that cause a turning point?
Again, I can't accept this terminology because people working for NATO and the CIA and Al-Qaeda, certainly not revolutionaries. The Libyan revolution is what's been in power for the past 40 years. I don't think a few hundred yards or a few kilometers here or there is going to make much difference. If you've been in Tripoli, as I have, you just see that there's a solid base of support for Gaddafi. We've now got NATO bombing the television station. I'm horrified. These are people that I know. You've got a guy there called Dr. Shakir. He's known as the Larry King of Libya with his late-night interview program. I was honored to be his guest a little bit more than a month ago. Now, that's declared terrorism. NATO now says that a peaceful television broadcast is terrorism, and they get to kill the people involved. I really wonder whether Western journalists want to go down that path, because some Libyan television journalists have been killed. This is now NATO declaring international anarchy. They can kill anybody they want to. That's the kind of dangerous situation out of which larger wars have been known to grow.
Well, Dr. Tarpley, as you say, NATO declares anarchy. I think if the U.S. wants to help Libya, it can overthrow Gaddafi's regime quickly. Why are they allowing these innocent civilian deaths to continue, and how long will this continue?
I don't see anywhere the United States could overthrow Gaddafi. I think that's much harder to do, as we've found out. NATO has been trying to eliminate him physically as hard as they could, and they have failed. And I think the attack on the television station is an example of NATO lashing out as they realize that defeat, actual defeat, political defeat, and the collapse of their coalition is staring them right in the face, because the center of gravity of the attacking forces is the attacking coalition. The only thing you can do beyond that is a ground invasion, which is specifically forbidden by the UN Security Council resolution. And if you want to see Obama impeached, watch that. It'll go very fast if he tries to send the Marines into Libya. The place is, in a certain way, an armed camp. There are 1 to 2 million Kalashnikovs in the hands of average people. There's a tribal organization which is made to order for guerrilla warfare. I can't think of any place that would be more difficult to invade than Tripoli and its environs, and that's based on firsthand experience.
Well, thank you for joining us, Dr. Tarpley. That was Webster Griffin Tarpley, author and historian, joining us on World News to give us the latest from his analyst, his point of view, from Libya.
Oh, that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're in bigger trouble than we ever thought by invading such a country. Anyway.
Well, and
we still got about 6 minutes left of the show here tonight. Let's see if there's something else we can play.
Honduran police burn community to the ground.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Homes, churches, schools, why would they do such a thing? Let's play a little bit of that.
Israeli ministers urge attack on Gaza.
That's nothing new.
That's the same. U.S. stocks plunged despite that deal. Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 265 points to 11,886 closing trade today. S&P dropped, everything dropped. Tuesday was the eighth straight day down to the markets, the longest losing streak since October 2008. Admiral Mike Mullins, outgoing chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, said Tuesday that any deal authorizing the extension of U.S. military presence in Iraq beyond December 2011 deadline would require the Iraqi parliament to give staying American soldiers legal immunity. Imagine that?
Wow.
That kind of agreement, which would include privileges and immunities for American men and women in uniform, will need to go through the parliament. And he added that the Iraqi officials could also clarify whether they want some American troops to stay on in the first place. So they could throw us right out of there, which is what I would hope they would do. Electromagnetic frequency exposure, asthma linked in kids.
Mm.
Research at the Kaiser
Permanente.
Yeah, in Oakland, California, gave 801 pregnant women tiny monitors to wear during pregnancy. The monitors recorded the expected mother's exposure to low-frequency magnetic fields emitted from electric and electronic devices such as microwaves, fans, fluorescent light bulbs, vacuum cleaners, coffee grinders, and power lines.
Oh, God, everything.
However, the monitors didn't measure the individual's exposure to higher-frequency electromagnetic fields generated by mobile phones and cell towers. This should be interesting. And scientists have followed the mothers until their children turned 13. According to the results, about 21% of the kids were diagnosed with asthma, most of them before the age of 5.
Wow.
The risk of developing asthma among children born to mothers with the highest electromagnetic frequencies exposure was 3.5 times higher than their peers born to women with lowest radiation level, said the report. And the results also revealed that the firstborn children and those born to mothers with a history of asthma are more vulnerable to developing asthma. Previous studies found an association between higher exposure to electromagnetic frequencies during pregnancy and increased risk of miscarriage. According to some animal studies, electromagnetic frequencies can affect the immune system and subsequently increase the risk of developing asthma. And researchers warned about the great risk of serious public health problems due to the individuals exposed to the magnetic fields through everyday life. LI suggested that pregnant women should lower their daily exposure to known magnetic field source and keep distance while using electronic and electric devices. Interesting. Interesting, I thought.
It's always something, I tell you.
So, yeah, microwaves and all that stuff, everybody's just being zapped. So anyway, we got about, we're right at the end of our show, we've got a minute left. And I was thinking, I want to thank everybody who joined us tonight. And I'd like to mention, please join me tomorrow night. Tomorrow night I'll have a special speech by Dr. David Ray Griffin, who is a theologian. But he talks about nationalist faith, okay?
Where is he going to be talking to us from?
It's a 2007 speech that he did at the Theological Society.
Oh, one that he'd already done.
But
okay.
He talks about nationalist faith and how it screws up, how it supersedes all logical reason when it comes to conspiracies, when it comes to what's happening around people and how they believe that the United States is so such a wonderful and wonderful country that no one would lie to you and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So they will be playing that tomorrow night in its entirety. It's a one-hour speech.
That would be worthwhile.
Very fascinating.
And you already listened to it and previewed it and thought it was...
So I want to thank everybody for joining us, and join us again tomorrow.
And good night, folks. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Yeah, good night, everybody.